ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults, and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, the Nanup 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello from David Rutledge. Welcome once again to the Philosopher's Zone right here on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. And at a time when the tensions, the hostilities between the Jewish and the Islamic worlds have never seemed so deep or so intractable, this is a conversation about a time when Judaism and Islam existed in a state of rich cross-fertilization and intellectual exchange. My guest this week is a historian who works on medieval Jewish philosophy. And for some listeners, that term Jewish philosophy is immediately going to sound like a contradiction. There is this modern assumption that philosophy is what you do when you want to inquire into the big questions of human existence, but you're not interested in any of the answers or the framing that religion might have to offer. But that assumption that philosophy is a strictly secular pursuit, that didn't really exist in the medieval world. And when we look at how thinkers of the time wrestled with issues like reason versus revelation, the problem of evil, the operation of the divine in the natural world, we can often be surprised to discover philosophy that speaks across the centuries to contemporary concerns. And of course, in the case of medieval Jewish philosophy, we find an intellectual tradition that's closely intertwined with Islamic thought. Raphael Daskalou is my guest. He's Senior Research Fellow in the History of Jewish Philosophy at the Centre for the History of Philosophy at Notre Dame University in Melbourne.
We approach pre-modern thought with so many assumptions about where the boundaries lie between religion and philosophy, the secular and the religious, what religion might be, which I think for the pre-modern world, I'm not convinced that people really had the same sense of what religion is. They certainly had confessional commitments. They were committed to their religious communities, right? They were engaged with certain bodies of literature and they were embedded in certain communities and embraced certain practices. But they didn't necessarily think of that in the way that we do today as this sort of neat category that all goes together of religion. And I think if we approach philosophy as a purely secular endeavor, we really have to do away with, firstly, almost all of the pre-modern philosophers and many of the moderns as well. I mean, even Descartes dabbles in theology, certainly Kierkegaard, certainly many modern philosophers cross that boundary. But the pre-moderns, I mean, the term for metaphysics in many traditions is the divine science, and it's very much concerned with the divine. I try to let go of those assumptions when I engage with pre-modern thinkers.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my sort of very broad understanding of it is that pretty well up until the Protestant Reformation, it doesn't make a lot of sense to sort of look at society and say, these people were religious, these people were not religious, you know, these people were secular. And I guess once you see that that sharp divide between secular reason and religious belief is not universal across time, then that hostility towards religious philosophy, quote unquote, it begins to look less inevitable. Is that what you're getting at there?
Yes. And to sharpen that observation, I'd point out that the philosophers across traditions, whether in the Latin West, in the Islamic world, or Jewish philosophers, saw themselves as more honest, more faithful adherents of their particular spiritual traditions. So they saw their own understanding of religious practice and their own theological understandings, and which is very much their metaphysics, as being more grounded in reality and true human insight. So they actually perceived themselves most often as the most truly, honestly religious people around, although they weren't using that language.
Yeah, I guess one expression of this modern sacred secular tension is the notion that philosophy is supposed to deal in universal truths, or at least in arguments that anyone at any time can assess and challenge, while religious traditions are supposedly specific to certain groups of believers. Their truths are grounded in revelation, and therefore humans have limited capacity for questioning them. And we see this tension, I guess, very clearly in Judaism, where you have an ongoing negotiation between revelation and reason, covenant and universal truth, law and metaphysics. So with all of that in mind, I want to ask you just quite simply, what is Jewish philosophy?
So many people have tried to answer that question, propose different theories.
And, of course, yeah.
And I have to lay my cards out on the table and say at the outset that from a historical perspective, as a historian of philosophy, I am a bit resistant to the project of trying to define it. And although many people have tried to define it, there are some who say that it's an impossibility for exactly the reason you just articulated, that whatever's Jewish is necessarily particular and whatever's philosophical is necessarily universal. So you can have a mix of philosophy and Judaism, but you can't have Jewish philosophy. That was a position articulated by Leon Roth, and I find it a strange position, firstly, to assume that everything that philosophy articulates is necessarily concerned with the universal. I'm not entirely convinced, or that anything belonging to a particular faith tradition is not universal, is particular and pertains only to that tradition, is also, I think, questionable. So others have pointed out that if a philosopher is writing from some kind of Jewish perspective, perhaps in a Jewish language, perhaps not, but trying to articulate positions that are Jewish positions or something like this, or bring it into conversation with the Jewish tradition, or write for a Jewish readership, those are factors that might help one to define somebody as a Jewish philosopher, as opposed to merely a Jew doing philosophy. I'm a bit resistant to the entire project of trying to define Jewish philosophy, and that's because I'm a historian. So I very much prefer to ask what I can learn from whatever sources are in front of me. So, for example, I think there are clear examples of Jews doing philosophy that are not Jewish philosophy. There's a correspondence from the mid-10th century between a Christian Aristotelian philosopher, Yahya ibn Adi, and some Jewish correspondence. And there's nothing Jewish about it. I don't think anybody would define that as Jewish philosophy. But if I'm a historian of philosophy and I want to understand Jewish engagement with philosophy, then that's relevant information. It helps to fill out a picture of the world and members of this particular community engaging in philosophical culture. But there are certain things that I think can help us to narrow it down a bit. Like I said, Jewish languages, some engagement with the Jewish corpus of literature. And in general, I think that engagement with literary corpora is a really important factor. So both in defining somebody as a philosopher and as a Jewish philosopher, what are they reading? What's on their bookshelf? So that to me is something of a guide, but I'm a bit resistant to trying to narrow it too much and define it too rigidly. I think, again, that comes down to approaching the data in front of us and the sources that we're reading with too many assumptions. I like to leave it open-ended.
You're a specialist in medieval Jewish philosophy. What is it about that particular period in Jewish intellectual history that interests you? And when exactly are we talking about?
So periodization is a really interesting question. I mean, how we chop up history, because nobody wakes up one morning and looks at the sky and discovers that it's the medieval period.
Mm-hmm.
That's they went to bed during the medieval period and woke up during modernity. Yeah. So very often we look at major events that have a deep cultural impact. And when it comes to the history of Jewish thought and Jewish culture, what bookends the medieval period is really, firstly, the early Islamic conquests on one end, and on the other end, the expulsion from Spain, the expulsion of Jews from Spain in 1492. Those are really two cataclysmic events. And the advent of Islam really opened up a new world to Jewish intellectuals. There was a translation movement fairly early on, and all of this literature just became firstly available to Jews. A very large part of the Greek philosophical corpus was translated into Arabic, and Jews were speaking Arabic by this point. They started out in the Islamic world mainly speaking other languages, mainly Aramaic and some Persian, but they started speaking Arabic. They took on the Arabic language and they began to read. And it produced really profound changes in Jewish thought. Before that, there was very little engagement with the philosophical tradition. And from then on, it flourished. So yeah, they start asking questions in a way that in earlier, especially classical rabbinic literature, they're not posing in the same way, thinking in more mythical terms. It's more through narrative. And I think they're often asking profound questions implicitly, but they're not asking them as explicitly and exploring them as systematically. And so it's a period of tremendous creativity and intellectual openness and rigor. I mean, one example of this is somebody who's often referred to as the first Jewish philosopher of the medieval period. And it's not really correct, but his name was Sadia Gaon, and he was born in Egypt and became the head of a rabbinic academy in Iraq. And firstly, he read everything that he could get his hands on, from biology to physics to cosmology. And he wrote these wonderful systematic works. You know, he wrote works on every branch of learning, from law through poetry and philosophy. And one example of this tremendous breadth of engagement is in one of his less known philosophical works. He has this sort of overview of 9 competing philosophical scientific cosmologies, theories of the cosmos and its sort of fundamental nature and structure. And he's just summarizes these 9 different worldviews without much judgment. You know, it's really to open up a world before the reader. So there's something in that curiosity and the rigor that I find really fascinating. It's certainly a time of deep intellectual engagement, deep literary engagement, a rethinking of really fundamental issues, but still bringing them into conversation with the earlier Jewish literary and intellectual tradition.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Raphael Daskalou from the Centre for the History of Philosophy at Notre Dame University in Melbourne. Tell me some more about the intellectual landscape here. I mean, what were Islamic scholars at the time thinking and writing about?
Firstly, they were thinking and writing about everything. Whatever you can conjure, they were very likely thinking and writing about it. They were writing about linguistics, they were writing about medicine, they were writing about optics, they were writing about botany. And a lot of these branches of especially the sciences came for them under the heading of philosophy. So their definition of philosophy was much broader than we tend to think today. It's certainly much broader than anything that would live or than anything that tends to live within philosophy departments in universities today. So they were writing about a tremendous breadth of material, and there were distinct intellectual movements. And I think we very often try to put people into very clear categories. There was some mixing and matching, but broadly speaking, there were Neoplatonists, there were Aristotelians, there were Mutakallimun, who were the systematic theologians. They engaged in kalam, in theology. And there were different schools of kalam, and they had different theories of physics. They had different theories of time. They had different theologies. And so there was this, firstly, a breadth of engagement across fields, and also a plurality and diversity of intellectual movements. And something that I think is interesting in the Jewish context is that Jews, as members of a minority and being associated with that community already as somewhat marginal, were probably a bit less inclined to align very clearly with one intellectual tradition or movement than another. They could be a little bit more eclectic as outsiders. And so, for example, Sadia Gaon, who I mentioned, is quite eclectic in his thought. And I think that's somewhat enabled by his marginal position in the society. But they're really writing about everything. They're really, it's a tremendously productive period. And it lives, in his case, in a period of state-sponsored scholarship and translation over centuries, a couple of centuries of the Abbasid Empire sponsoring this tremendous sort of scientific project, which that in particular was a very vibrant intellectual environment.
You mentioned translation there, hugely important here. Can you expand some more on the role that language and the work of translation played in medieval Jewish intellectual life?
Mm. So first of all, translation opened up the world of the Greco-Arabic philosophical tradition to Jews. It was their engagement in literary Arabic that enabled them to read philosophical literature and engage with it. It also shaped their literary output. So from the 9th century, there are Jews writing in literary Arabic, and it's what's called literary Judeo-Arabic. So they're writing in Hebrew script. They're occasionally using Hebrew vocabulary, depending on the genre and the intended reader, but they'll be drawing on some element of Hebrew and Aramaic vocabulary. But it's fundamentally a literary Arabic that's written in Hebrew script. And from the 9th through the, actually really through the 15th centuries, there are Jews writing in this literary Judeo-Arabic, and they're producing scientific and philosophical literature in Judeo-Arabic. In Western Europe, there are Jews who have an appetite for philosophy, and they begin from the 12th century really consuming that in Hebrew translation. And it shapes the language. I mean, the fact that they're reading Hebrew translations of Arabic philosophical works actually shapes their language so that they end up writing Hebrew as if they're translating it from Arabic, but they don't know Arabic. So,
yeah.
So it really shapes the language and it shapes the genres. But yeah, so language both as an enabling force and a shaping force is very much there, but it also, it's interesting to look at language as a vehicle of this intellectual production is really fascinating.
This was a time of Jewish exposure to Greek philosophy. The Islamic thinkers of the day were engaged, as I understand it, in reconciling Aristotelian and Neoplatonic ideas with Islamic theology. How was this relationship between reason and revelation taking shape in Jewish thought?
Very early on, there are thinkers that frame that question very sharply. So Sadia Gaon, for example, he will talk about revelation and reason, arguments brought from authoritative texts and those based on reason. And you'll find that in a number of works. I think that there is something really interesting in the works of Maimonides, for example, where for him, ultimately, the spiritual texts, the authoritative texts, have to be a product of profound human reason, but therefore also we have to be really committed to honest and deep thought. Otherwise, we're not going to understand the inner logic and inner workings of the prophetic tradition. So he actually calls philosophical religion, meaning an understanding of the Torah that is really anchored in philosophy. He calls that in Arabic a sharia ala haqiqatiha. It is religion or the law in its true sense, in truth, in reality. So for him, it's not like you have two separate things that you have to reconcile. It's rather that when we bury deep into one, we find the other. So they're really deeply enmeshed for him. And I think there are certainly people that resisted philosophy because they saw reason and revelation and as it being in some kind of competition, or that we can't trust our own reason. But I think that the philosophers are very committed to the idea that the deeper you go, the more you are discovering that it's all just divine truth. That's what we have. So they had quite a harmonious view ultimately of the relationship between those two things.
One thing that really interests me is that we already have in the medieval period a very sophisticated tradition of theodicy, this question of how it is that a beneficent God can allow evil and suffering to exist. And of course, Jews had experienced the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple twice, first by the Babylonians, then by the Romans. They had been a people in exile with all the privations and dangers that exile can incur. How did the experience of living under Islamic rule and the engagement with Islamic philosophy, how did that feed into Jewish attempts to understand evil and suffering?
I think that the earlier traditions, meaning pre-philosophical rabbinic traditions, really focus on, first of all, exile and suffering as some kind of punishment for wrongdoing. So it's not that it's undeserved. That is a traditional view. Although in specific concrete circumstances, they'll say, we just don't know. Or there can even be divine error, right? But big picture, exile and suffering sort of make sense in this world of divine reward and punishment in some way. At the same time, the divine grieves the suffering that it causes to human beings, to its children, and of course to the Jewish people more specifically. The philosophers will approach it a bit differently because they'll frame it in more universal terms, as you know, as you framed it, in terms of the problem of theodicy, right? And especially in the Aristotelian tradition, with Maimonides as the most shining example, they'll basically deny all reality to evil. They will basically say it's not really a thing. There are harms. And there are harms to specific subjects, and we frame them as evils. But in the broader picture of the world, this is just the way that the world works. There's something a bit more specific, which is how do we respond to suffering in our lives? And that's something else. It becomes a mechanism for reflection and ethical cultivation. So the response is dig deep, try to make yourself better. You know, that's Maimonides' response. And he says any other response is callousness. So it's sort of used as a tool for self-refinement. But in and of itself, evil is not a thing. So that's a really classical sort of philosophical position. So it's a little different from what came before it, and it's a little different from, for example, in the Jewish mystical tradition where, I mean, there are also people that deny ontological reality to evil, but generally speaking, in the Kabbalistic tradition, the demonic is real. It's a part of our world. You know, there is evil, where in the philosophical tradition, there are subjects that suffer, and we have to work out what to do with that suffering. That's more the direction that they take it.
Well, Raphael, just to zoom out a bit, you mentioned to me in a previous conversation that pre-modern societies have a lot to teach us about how to confront this disturbing and challenging world that we're living in today, which I've been thinking a lot about because for anyone with their intellectual training firmly grounded in modern rationalist secular philosophy, the medieval world seems like a very distant planet. So what can we learn from it?
It's interesting when you describe the medieval as alien to the moderns. And I think we do one of two things. Either we assume that they're so different from us that we can't understand them, or we assume that we can sort of open up whatever they wrote with all of our baggage and with all of our assumptions and just read it and be in conversation with it. And my doctoral supervisor said to me that the way to read is to first make the people that we're reading alien, and then you can make them familiar to you again. And so I think that it's true that the medievals are in some ways distant and we have to let go of our baggage. But I do think that there are really fundamental human insights that are accessible to us and useful to us. And one of these things that I've been finding very useful, because I'm sure like everybody, I struggle with the news feed. I wake up and dive straight into the news feed and it compulsively and without thought. And it just punctuates my day, this sort of engagement with the news feed. And I think that we're taught at the moment to think of global geopolitics as this really big part of our lives. We're constantly engaged in these big picture processes, and we're told that the political is really the avenue for meaning in our life, you know, and especially like sort of political engagement in that really modern sense, as opposed to the medieval sense, which is more interpersonal. And I feel that the medievals and pre-moderns in general can help us to reframe a little bit of how we think about that. Sure, we need to ask ourselves, how do I respond, right? I'm a citizen of this country who votes and I try to be informed and I try to make as wise decisions as I can around such things. But there's so much that is outside of my hands. Most of this is outside of my hands. I'm a drop in an ocean. And what the medievals and ancients teach us is that our lives are an ongoing process of cultivation of the self across all of these different avenues and all these different parts of our lives. So there's the moral, the ethical, and that's about training ourselves and refining ourselves in relationship with others. And then there are all of these different fields of study and being engaged, let's say, with physics, having some kind of understanding of the sciences, of the humanities, of these different branches of learning is, to my mind, at least as important as engagement with the political in the way that we tend to think about it today. And to me, there's something really clarifying and liberating about that. It doesn't get me entirely off the hook. I don't want to be off the hook, but it does help to remind me that when my energy is really going entirely into sort of navigating the news feed and articulating my positions on global events, that there are other things. There's how I train myself to be a patient human when I am at the post office or stuck behind somebody in traffic or interacting with somebody on the other side of a counter or with my family members and my friends. So, I mean, that is a real profound philosophical practice. That is the locus of meaning for so many of the medievals. That's how we train ourselves. And it's how we make ourselves luminous, how we polish our souls.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the news feed, which is far from luminous right at this moment, showing us so much fear and hostility in particular between Jews and Muslims. Of course, not all Jews and Muslims, but the broad tensions are there for all to see. How can studying the history of philosophy contribute to modern interfaith understanding?
It's interesting that it's often missing from a lot of interfaith discourse. And I do think that especially the sort of classical ethical tradition, which in both Islamic tradition and Jewish tradition has a very deep engagement with the Aristotelian tradition, with what we often call virtue ethics. I think, so what's called in Arabic akhlaq and in Hebrew middot, and that tradition of cultivating virtues, of training oneself to be patient and to be humble, and to be kind, and to be generous, and to judge favorably. That is something that, firstly, there's such a rich literature about this, you know, across Jewish and Islamic tradition. And I think that often when we engage in a conversation about something, it helps us to have a conversation that's not just about each other or just about ourselves. There's something there that we can talk about. And there's a very rich common language there and a common project of trying to be more moral agents in the world, better agents in the world, and I think it can be incredibly productive. As far as I can see, it's relatively unexplored as a strategy of engaging across those divides. But I do think that it holds promise. I think that it has potential.
Raphael Daskalou, Senior Research Fellow in the History of Jewish Philosophy at Notre Dame University in Melbourne. And you've been listening to The Philosopher's Zone. You can find more information about today's guest on The Philosopher's Zone website, and you can catch any or all of our past episodes via ABC Listen. ABC Listen, of course, being your one-stop shop for not just this one, but a treasury of Radio National podcasts. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by me, David Rutledge, on the lands of the Bundjalung people. Thanks so much for joining me this week, and I look forward to your company again next time. Bye for now.